Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
When you read recipes for bread, they're very vague and like, you know, wait till the dough is soft and billowy. And you're just kind of like, okay, I don't know what a lot of these things mean. And then all of a sudden, it just kind of clicks.
Mike Siebers mastered the art of baking bread while on the job at Feast Restaurant. He tells us what makes a good sourdough, and we watch as he assembles an espresso rye. Hydroponic plants plus fish equals the latest craze in year-round growing. Author and food activist Mark Winnie says local food policy councils can do a lot to affect change in the food system. And ramps. Preserve them now to enjoy once they're long gone for the season. What's happening in the world of food news with Luann Johnson?
Europe has shown once again that its approach to food chemicals is more restrictive than that of North America. In the U.S. and Canada, conventionally grown apples and pears are coated with a pesticide to keep them from turning brown, from scald, and to extend shelf life. Diphenylamine, more commonly known as DPA, is not a proven health hazard, but some research points to its possible connection to carcinogens. Last month, the European Union dramatically restricted the amount of DPA allowed on fruit imports. The average levels found on apples and pears from the U.S. is 4 times greater than those restrictions. In 2010, the U.S. Department of Agriculture found DPA on 80% of U.S. apples. Those tests are performed after the apples are washed, by the way. The EU ban sheds light on a fundamental difference in how governments approach possible health risks from chemicals. Over the course of a few years, the EU body investigated DPA risks, asking companies that produce the chemical to demonstrate its safety. Ultimately, the ban went into effect because of a lack of safety data. Chad Bouchard went into more detail about this story on our website, eartheats.org. The gap between what consumers think they're getting when they purchase organic products and what they are actually getting is larger than most people think. A majority of consumers believe that labeling food organic means it doesn't contain pesticides or antibiotics. The truth is, only 100% organic labeling means products only contain organic ingredients. Certified organic means 95% of the product is organic, while the other 5% can come from a USDA-approved list of ingredients. The USDA grants 5-year exemptions to allow synthetic material in organic products without notifying the public. The dollar menus have it all wrong. A Cornell University study found that diners appreciate their food more if they pay more for it. 139 diners ate at an upscale Italian all-you-can-eat buffet. Some were charged $4 per meal. The rest were charged $8. Researchers discovered that although the amount of food consumed was the same, those who paid more for their meals enjoyed them more. Those who paid less reported feeling bloated and guilty. People often equate quality with price, even when that's not the case. Lobster is a good example. Lobster prices are at an all-time low, but restaurant prices are not reflecting that reality. And fast food workers will go on strike again on May 15th, according to labor organizers. Workers are calling for companies like McDonald's, Burger King, and Yum! Brands to raise hourly pay to $15. Protests will likely take place in up to 150 American cities, as well as 33 countries worldwide. Food news all day, every day, on our Twitter feed, at Earth Eats.
One more shout out to the website, which is where you can learn more about these news stories, eartheats.org. Our food news from Luann Johnson.
See you next time.
Farmers all over the country are using hydroponic technology to grow produce indoors year-round in nutrient-rich water. And fish farmers around the globe have figured out how to raise their catch in tanks. Now, some operations are combining the two, raising both produce and fish. For Harvest Public Media, Pat Blank reports from Iowa.
When overnight temperatures dipped into the 20s in early spring, Bob Molds wasn't worried about his lettuce crop getting frostbite, nor was he concerned that his tanks of tilapia would freeze. That's because they're tucked away in a climate-controlled 6,000-square-foot greenhouse.
We raise fish to produce nutrients in the water, of which bacteria converts those waste from the fish into usable nutrients and provide the food for the plants.
Molds is president and CEO of All Seasons Harvest near Cedar Falls, Iowa. He and his two sons have been fine-tuning their product line for more than a year.
My goodness, we planted snow peas, we planted cayenne peppers, we have some miniature zucchinis, we've tried strawberries, of course cherry tomatoes, regular tomatoes, and a lot of different herbs. And we have zeroed in on the best thing here is lettuce, herbs, and kale.
That lettuce, herbs, and kale is fed with nutrient-rich water provided by several tanks of freshwater tilapia, the sixth most common seafood product in the U.S. The operation has the attention of the state of Iowa's horticulturalist, Mike Bevins, who toured the facility a few weeks ago.
The fact that it's self-contained is just so cool. You know, it's a great example of a sustainable system. In this kind of a system, animal waste isn't considered a pollutant or a toxic material or anything. It's a crucial nutrient for plant growth. So it really demonstrates that symbiotic relationship between plants and animals.
Bevin says many Iowa produce growers have dabbled in methods to let them start the season early or end it later. But All Seasons Harvest has combined hydroponic and aquaculture under one roof, thus aquaponics.
You not only have year-round produce production, but you have fish production as well, all in a closed system.
Aquaponics operations first sprung up in the 1980s, and now you can find aquaponic growers all over the country. Mike Bevin says part of the All Seasons Harvest success has been the fact that the Molds family has two horticulturalists, an engineer, perseverance, and a bank account that supports the entrepreneurial spirit.
You know, it's a very high investment. It's very labor intensive, so it's not something that a lot of people are going to get into. Is all that worth it? Is it going to pay off in the long run? Well, that's going to be dependent on whether consumers support this type of local production.
And for Bob Molds, so far, so good. His lettuce is already in local grocery stores, and the tilapia market is being developed.
Our target is to have about 50% of our product sold wholesale through retailers, and the other 50% of ours sold through restaurants, through catering services, and retirement, like homes and so forth.
Molds explains that herbicides, insecticides, and other chemicals cannot be used in the process because they would harm the fish. But as pure as the operation is, he says he's frustrated by the way his product has to be labeled.
Even though we are 100% natural, we use essentially nothing except extracts from plants and natural pests, we cannot be certified organic, because the standards that were written for organic is growing things in dirt.
Molt says there's a movement underfoot, as he puts it, to develop a label for his and others like it to be classified as all natural. But it may take years to get USDA certification. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Pat Blank.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focused on issues of food, fuel, and field. More stories like this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. When I say the word feast, what images pop into your mind? A big table with lots of people, maybe a Thanksgiving turkey, goblets filled with red wine? As your mind is filling in the details, you've probably placed a basket of bread on the table. Can't have a feast without a bread product or two. That's the feeling diners get at Feast, the restaurant in Bloomington. Bread is the linchpin for so many of their dishes. But they're not dishing out those puffy white rolls that are only really good for sopping up gravy. How about some blue cheese walnut or rosemary nichoise bread? Creations from the imagination of baker Mike Siebers. Head chef and owner of Feast, Erica Yoakum, has watched Siebers put his personal stamp on their bread.
When we first kind of asked Mike to step in and help with the baking, he was like, yeah, I can make bread. Like, I think you looked at it in a totally different way than you look at it now. And we were like, you have to know the bread and become one with the bread. And you were like, okay, you guys are like, really? And we were like, no, really? And he was like, and he has. Like, I've seen it happen. It's like, he just knows his bread.
He dedicates some 70-plus hours every week to baking bread. It appeals to both the super-specific part of his brain as well as the more free-flowing part.
The measuring process is very precise, like down to the gram. But I feel like the real skill in baking comes with knowing when the bread is fermenting correctly and knowing at what point you can now start separating these into loaves.
Siebers talks about the intuition of baking bread, knowing when to stop handling it, knowing when it's too warm in the kitchen. The feel of baking is something he's developed over time, and not really with the help of recipes, because if you've tried to follow a bread recipe, you know how esoteric they can be.
Like, you know, wait till the dough is soft and billowy, and you're just kind of like, okay, I don't know what a lot of these things mean, and then you're trying to make bread, and all of a sudden it just kind of clicks, and you say, oh, okay, this feels soft and billowy.
He recently moved to a new baking facility so he can have the kitchen all to himself, but that doesn't mean he'll be expanding the operation.
You know, I think that there is kind of a terminal capacity with this, that where it would just become too much for one person or two people to handle. You know, even in France, where this is what they do, they only do so much before they kind of put the brakes on it, and you know,
before the quality is going to start to suffer.
Exactly.
And we're going to stay small, and this is just what we're going to do. This is us.
Head chef Erica Yoakum and bread baker Mike Siebers. Mike will be back in the second half of the show. If you're a fan of rye bread, you will definitely want to keep listening. The first Food Policy Council was founded in Knoxville, Tennessee in 1982. Since then, over 200 FPCs have started operating at the local, state, and regional levels across the country. Mark Winnie has been an integral part of several food policy groups. He's perhaps best known for serving as executive director of the Hartford Food System from 1979 to 2003. EarthEats' Tara Cobb called up Winnie to find out how food policy councils can impact our local food systems.
Mark Winnie started off his career in the Hartford, Connecticut food system, where he co-founded a number of food and agriculture policy groups, including the City of Hartford Food Policy Commission. Now, he serves as senior advisor to the Food Policy Networks Project at the Johns Hopkins University Center for a Livable Future. Winnie draws on his personal experience to talk about food policy councils and the importance of public policy in addressing issues of hunger and food insecurity.
So food policy councils take on urban gardening, they take on food insecurity, they take on the health-related issues such as obesity. That's kind of a full range of topics, you might say, within our food system. And they're doing it from the point of view of trying to say, well, what more and how can we use our governments more effectively to be able to address these problems? And then the other thing that food policy councils do is they actually coordinate. They try to coordinate the activities and the sort of overall work of all these different groups, of these different stakeholders. The idea is to say, hey, folks, can we come up with a common vision for our community when it comes to food?
From his point of view, FPC should focus on public policy to ensure that all levels of government are dedicated to effecting positive change. He notes that improving the food system is about more than just increasing access to healthy foods.
In the City of Hartford, there was better access to healthy food through farmers markets, through expansion and urban gardens. So, you know, gradually there has been an increase and an improvement in, you know, the availability of good food. I can't say that the overall income poverty situation has improved much. It's not something that can be resolved easily just by, you know, having more food and better food available. You know, that really points to some systemic problems in our economy, you know, that need to be addressed through such things as, you know, much higher minimum wages or living wages that need to be paid, as well as improvements in our educational system.
But can we really expect community members to make a considerable impact in their local food systems?
I certainly hope so. You know, if I'm a citizen of a community and if I'm a voter, I certainly think I have the right to speak up and to let my elected officials know what I think is necessary in order for us to have a good, strong, healthy food system. I think it's my right, and I think it's my obligation. Now, will our policy makers always listen? Well, no, they won't, but it certainly means that we should be at the table. It may take time to have some real impact, but when we bring together lots of voices and a common voice around what we think our food system should look like, I think our policymakers will pay attention and they will begin to act accordingly.
Winnie says activists have made some strong gains, at least when it comes to day-to-day improvements in the food system.
While we may not be able to solve immediately through the work of food, solve the problems of poverty and the underlying causes of food insecurity and poor health, we certainly can address a lot of the symptoms, and we can make the lives of people a lot better than they are now. And we can also, at the same time, improve the overall quality of living in our communities through food.
For Earth Eats, I'm Tara Cobb.
Mark Winnie is the author of Closing the Food Gap and Food Rebels, Guerrilla Gardeners, and Smart Cookin' Mamas. Lucky Guy lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico right now. His website is markwinne.com. And a big thanks to Earth Eats' Tara Cobb for that interview. Coming up, Chef Daniel Orr has a couple recipes using ramps. He also shares some foraging tips.
You can find the flowering heads after they've kind of, passed the edible stage. And you want to let those be, but burn that into your mind so next year in the spring you can go back and find them.
Get these wild onions while you still can. Ramps season is almost over. More coming up. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Bloomington Hypnosis, with certified hypnotist and self-hypnosis instructor John Hunkler, helping clients relax into weight loss for health and fitness. Bloomington Hypnosis, 812-200-5005.
What I'm doing right now, it is an espresso rye.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan, back in the kitchen at Feast with baker Mike Siebers. Before he moved to a new baking facility, he was relegated to the basement at Feast, where it was very hot, very, very hot. He suffered through it because heat is what the yeast needs to do its thing. This bread, the espresso rye, will be part of their Reuben sandwich. Let's take a listen.
When I was looking at rye recipes, dark rye recipes, most of them are colored with either molasses or instant espresso, but I wasn't finding anything with espresso or coffee or anything in there. But I'm thinking back that, 100 years ago, they didn't have instant espresso, so there has to be coffee in some of these recipes. So I just decided to try it, and it works.
Can you really taste the coffee in the bread?
You can taste it in the crust at the very finish.
We'll follow him along the process of making the bread, or at least the very first stages of it, because this is going to take a full day. Siebers maintains a sourdough starter in his kitchen, which is the basis of everything he makes. I wanted to ask about my particular favorite bread, the Fireball.
The sourdough, the base sourdough bread, And then we add in Delaware Fireball Salami, which is made by Smoking Goose, which is a small meat cure in Indianapolis. And then it's got toasted pistachios and provolone cheese.
So salami, pistachios, cheese, walnuts, is there anything that can't go in bread?
I haven't found anything that doesn't find a home for bread or a home in bread. But one thing that I'm kind of trying to strive for is make sure that the base sourdough is as good as it can be, because I don't want to lean on, you know, the ingredients that I'm adding in there to make the bread good. The bread, I feel like it has to be good to start with.
What makes a good sourdough in baking and then in the taste? What are you looking for?
Sourdough is kind of a catch-all term, I guess, for natural leavened bread. What I think the biggest thing that makes a good sourdough is allowing the yeast and the yeast the time to do its thing. The sourness comes from there's a bacteria that kind of lives with wild yeast that when it's feeding, it produces an acid. So the sour taste that you're getting is actually the acid that the bacteria is producing. That only happens if you allow the yeast to ferment the bread at a certain rate. The yeast is heat sensitive, the bacteria isn't. So there's kind of a sweet spot where you'll get this real nice sour taste. Beyond that, it's just kind of knowing how to feel the dough.
You just added a whole bunch of flour there as we were talking.
A whole bunch of flour, yeah. This is it's a mixture of white flour and rye flour. And it's a mixture of just water and brewed Brown County espresso. So.
And now you're just kneading and kneading around and around and around.
I think a lot of people think that you have to really, really work bread over, work the dough over. My growing philosophy is that you get it mixed and you handle it as little as possible. Every movement is developing the gluten structure, which is giving the bread its shape. And I'm going to let it rest for 20 to 40 minutes. At that point, I will add in the salt, and I'll add in the caraway seeds. And that will start the bulk fermentation.
And I'm eating this bread when? Tomorrow?
Tomorrow. This will be baked sometime in the wee hours of the morning tonight.
Will you be here?
I will be here, yes.
How many hours do you work, dude?
A lot. A lot. The whole process on making a loaf of bread is about 23 hours or so. It's a very slow process. Like I was saying before, you have to be patient and let the yeast do its thing. There are many ugly stages of bread making, but the end is beautiful.
Mike Siebers, bread baker at Feast in Bloomington, Indiana. Seeing a photo of his bread really doesn't even come close to tasting it. But that's all we can offer on the website. Sorry. EarthEats.org.
A quick trip to the market to pick up some goodies for our recipe today. Early spring in certain parts of the Midwest means ramps, which are wild onions with a strong garlic taste. Along with morel mushrooms, ramps are a forager's prize find. John Allen Flynn has a whole bunch of ramps for sale at his booth.
Yeah, I got quite a few of them.
So is this the perfect time of year to pick some ramps?
This is the best time of year because it's nice and cool. The ramps are one of the first things that comes up in the woods at the beginning of the year in the spring. You'll know it's spring when you see these little bitty leaves are sticking up.
So let's talk to people who want to forage for ramps and they've never done it before. Give some tips.
Gosh, I don't know. I found them on my farm. But you don't just find them everywhere, because I mushroom hunt and stuff like that in a lot of different woods. You don't really run into ramps that often for some reason. I don't know why they're all over my farm, but I'm glad they are.
So how do you like to eat them?
I like to eat them just in potato leek soup, potato ramp soup. You can use them in omelets. You can use them stir fry with them. But you can use them anyway. Use an onion or garlic.
Have a good day. Yes, sir.
Chef Daniel Orr has some additional thoughts about cooking ramps. He's also a forager himself.
The thing about ramps is it's a very fleeting season. You can find the flowering heads after they've kind of, you know, passed the edible stage, and you want to let, you know, let those be, but burn that into your mind so next year in the spring you can go back and find them. There's only one foraged item that I would suggest that you pick clear, and that's the wild garlic mustard greens, which is very invasive. But with the ramps, always leave some, so next year there'll be another supply of them. We're going to do a pickled ramp, and then we're also going to do a ramp pesto. So what we've done is we've cut off these green tops, and I've put them in a nice pickling jar, and we're going to make a brine to pour over them, and then we can keep them in the refrigerator for, you know, 6 months, 8 months, a year, and you can utilize that vinegar for the flavor into vinaigrettes and sauces and things, and then you can also pull out the ramps and eat them like pickles, let's say with a cheese platter or with smoked meats, things like that. You can use them in lots of different things. You can also chop them up and put them in a sauce or sprinkle them on top of a roasted fish. So there's lots of ways you can use them. We're going to go over to the stove. I've got a pan on, and we're going to show you how to do a quick brine. All right, so I've got about 2 cups of vinegar.
Any type of vinegar here?
I'm using cider vinegar, but really whatever you want. If you have, you know, maybe some homemade tarragon vinegar, or you have some rice wine vinegar, you could go a little Asian with the rice wine vinegar. You may throw in some star anise if you wanted to. So, you know, just whatever direction you want to go. But basically, it's the acid that we're looking for. About 1.5 cups of granulated sugar, and about 2 or 3 teaspoons of salt. And then I've got some spices. And today I've got some homegrown bay leaves that I keep in the house all winter and then take out and put in the garden in the summertime. And then I've got a little bit of cinnamon stick, some cloves, some crushed red pepper, and then some coriander and fennel seeds. Now, if you're really against sugar, you could use honey or agave syrup. What you're looking for is just to bring out that sweetness. So you could put maple syrup in this too, which would be another flavor. You have to be careful with a glass container when you put hot liquids in it that it won't crack. Just add a little vinegar at a time, and you're going to temper the glass, let it heat up slightly before adding a whole lot of the vinegar mixture. Okay, and you want to get all those spices and the bay leaves and cinnamon, everything down in there. Okay, we're going to seal this, and this is just a standard pickling jar, and you've got a beautiful batch of pickled ramps. Come back in 2 weeks, and I'll let you taste them.
You got it. Daniel Orr did not pickle the greens. Instead, he used some to make a pesto, and others served as wrappings for cod fillets, like little ramps presents. These recipes will give you the confidence you need to pick up some ramps at your farmer's market and make something delicious at home. Go for it. EarthEats.org is where you can follow the recipes. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Tara Cobb, John Allen Flynn, Lauren Glapa, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, Mike Siebers, Mark Winnie, Erica Yoakum, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 3 locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, 1 block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Bloomington Hypnosis, with certified hypnotist and self-hypnosis instructor John Hunkler, helping clients relax into weight loss for health and fitness. Bloomington Hypnosis, 812-200-5005. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Good food, good people. For Earth Eats, I'm Annie Corrigan.